Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints on today's show. Black History Month is coming up this February under the theme, All That We Carry.
The uncomfortable truth is that many people have died and fought for me to be here this morning, stand shoulder to shoulder with my brothers and sisters to represent our black community.
Paintings of New Brunswick-born Edward Mitchell Bannister come to Sackville, courtesy of the Smithsonian Museum. The exhibit is entitled Hidden Blackness.
Anthony Blinken said that art encourages us to test our humanity and to connect with others.
The town of Cobourg is rethinking its position on issuing religious declarations, this after being asked to designate a day in March as Atheist Awareness Day.
If you want to open the door to faith-based proclamations, then you've opened it all the way.
In Ontario, the Wilfrid Laurier University kicks off a new Indigenous online course.
This is the history of Canada, and this needs to be taught. Is there so much misinformation out there about Indigenous people?
A Concordia University student attends the COP29 meeting in Azerbaijan and shares his experience with us.
I always thought that COPs weren't amounting to anything, and I thought, oh, might as well go there and see what actually happens there. And so I ended up going out of curiosity, actually.
And a staff salmon hatchery will be built on the north bank of the Nechako River in BC. Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, thanks for being with us again this week. My name is Boris Chassai and I'll be with you for the next half hour. So you know that February is BHM in Canada. A motion to recognize the Black History Month across the country was unanimously approved by the House of Commons in 1995. This year's Black History Month, or BHM, will take place under the theme All That We Carry. Speaking at Place des Arts during the launch, the BHM Roundtable shared the February slate of programming spanning exhibitions, talks, concerts, social events, and more. They also announced a brand new Black History Book Club, which will this year put the spotlight on 12 community laureates. Jules Bugiel in Montreal, Quebec, met up with Ian Thomas, spokesperson for the 2025 BHM.
I think it's important that everybody should have a duty in the Black community to help out in their own way. We don't all have to be community activists. We don't all have to be workshop facilitators. A small gesture, just like a welcome greeting when you see another black person, can go a long way. Because the uncomfortable truth is that many people have died and fought for me to be here this morning, stand shoulder to shoulder with my brothers and sisters to represent our black community. So when Nadia called me, she said, listen, we want you to be spokesperson for Black History Month, I thought it was my time to step up and represent for my culture.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Lots to do during that month also across the country. In New Brunswick, for example, they are gearing up for the Hidden Blackness exhibit, presenting works by painter Edward Mitchell Bannister. He was born in 1828. He died in 1901. Bannister was a black artist born in St. Andrews, New Brunswick. He spent most of his adult life in Providence, Rhode Island, where he was also a prominent abolitionist and philanthropist. Hidden Blackness is the first major exhibition of Edward Mitchell Bannister's work ever presented in Canada, 124 years after the artist's death. Conservator Gwen Manthey was in Sackville last week, along with a group of paintings that will be featured in the Hidden Blackness exhibition. Manthey is a painting conservator with the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C. Erica Butler in New Brunswick dropped into the Owens Art Gallery to speak with Manthey to first ask her how she came to care for Bannister's paintings.
We got a lot of works in there through a massive gift, and I became familiar with them because they were regularly used for government loans. That's another loan that we fulfill to federal office buildings in D.C., as well as traveling exhibitions. So a number of these had been prepared for loan, were not chosen, and there was the one work in the gallery. And because those works were not chosen, I was, also had never heard of the artist, I started to look him up. up. And that's where rabbit holes are formed if you are somebody that likes to learn. Because he is a fascinating character, and that's why his works are on display here too. It's simply access and being cognizant and aware of the things that are around you. Anyone who's interested in their profession, there's going to be something that fascinates them that they hadn't heard of. So that's how I came to know Bannister, as well as being introduced to him from other interested scholars. But because I'm entrusted with the care of the collection, I got to spend a bit more time looking than they did.
Tell me a bit about him. He was, well, in addition to, you clearly have a love of his work, but he's also, he's also a very interesting person, and was an activist, a community, like an upstanding citizen in his community. Tell me a bit about his life.
So what we know is mostly third party. What other people have written about him, as well as receipts, documents, and newspaper articles. After leaving New Brunswick when his family died, he moved to Boston with his older brother William. Other scholars have told us that he was a longshoreman and he was apprenticed to cobbler. These are all very tactile, manual labor jobs. But he gets to Boston, where there is a really active abolitionist community. I believe the number was, and I need to double check that again, up to 40% of free blacks in Boston were barbers. And so he's taking, his ability to work with his hands and taking that into a career that will use the skills that he has, but also introduce him to a vast network of people. Free self-emancipators, other potential artisans, abolitionists, social justice warriors, but then also potential clients, and wealthy white people too. I believe I mentioned in the talk, there's a book where most black barbers were actually, their clients were white men. And so you've got this interesting duality of a black man holding a knife to a white man's throat. And how can you get to that point? And that's through developing trust and rapport and conversation. So that's one of his jobs. And then from there, he goes to photographer. And he starts painting these photographs as well. The democratization of the image, a low-cost way of getting your visage. And especially for people who were volunteering to go off to war, that memento is going to be very important. And how do you make something like that even special? Well, you can paint it if you can't afford the gold to put around the case. I believe that he would have fought for the 54th or volunteered in some capacity. This is my own hypothesis. But he had a weak heart, and that might have been from being exposed to photographic chemicals. But he became an artist, and he threw all of his energy into caring for others.
Bannister, do we know if he was a painter in his youth before he left New Brunswick? Would we have paintings that date from that time? Do you know at all?
Well, we know the watercolors that are going to be on display. And I don't have the provenance on that, but Emily does. These are watercolors he could have made while he's here in New Brunswick. We have, it's the established tradition to become an artist by starting to copy known works. And when you don't have a museum available, you can look to the printed image. Newspapers were probably the most accessible. And so even works of art, when they're reprinted, can be reproduced. As I understand, the Owens Art Gallery itself had a really rich watercolor training program here. So I would love to do more research in the area to see what works in this collection were actually extant and in the areas where Bannister was working. And there is a piece in the Smithsonian American Art Collection known as Dorchester. And I believe it was painted in the 1850s, or that's the date. I have not had my hands on the artwork with enough time to understand why it was called Dorchester, but it could have been misnamed with the assumption that it was from the Massachusetts Boston area and overlooking the Dorchester area near here in Sackville. So it will take some digging in his historic photographs, as well as what are the landmarks available, where are there houses on this rise next to the sea that would have been possible for Bannister to paint in the area. So it is possible, it just takes time, and time is the one resource that you can't create necessarily. So getting other people interested in the project too, or I shouldn't say the project, but just interested in Bannister to help understand and contextualize these paintings is key.
Give me the sales pitch for locals in Sackville, why they should definitely come to the Owens to check out this exhibition.
One of the interesting things about Bannister is you can come from it from many lens points beyond the art. You've got the racial and social politics. You've got the progression of technology and image making throughout his life. You've got the nuanced understanding of what it takes to be a salesperson as well in Bannister. There are many different stories that can be told from individual artworks, be it the hidden composition, the visible composition, what these landscapes mean to the area, but as well as I had mentioned, you know, what brought Bannister's family here, the history of mining, logging, resources from the sea, too. And finding those links to the paintings themselves. It's possible for anyone from any background to find something of themselves and some interest in these artworks. And actually, something that I forgot to mention as I started my quote, so I'm happy to repeat it here. I attended something recently where Anthony Blinken, the former United States Secretary of State, commented that, and I do not want to misquote this, Anthony Blinken said that art encourages us to test our humanity and to connect with others. You can use art as that vehicle for conversation, that object-based therapy to start a bigger discussion about what individual priorities are, and even use that landscape to understand how your own personal landscape has changed and whose priorities made it change.
That's Gwen Manthey, a paintings conservator with the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C., who is in Sackville this week, along with paintings for a show opening this Friday at the Owens. Hidden Blackness features the works of Edward Mitchell Bannister, a Black artist born in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, who spent most of his adult life in Providence, Rhode Island, where he was also a prominent abolitionist and philanthropist. Hidden Blackness opens this Friday with a vernissage scheduled for 7 p.m. at the Owens Art Gallery. This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
An Ontario D town of Cobourg is rethinking its position on issuing religious declarations after being asked to designate a day in March as Atheist Awareness Day. Last November, D town passed a controversial motion to proclaim December as a Christian Heritage Month, but a motion by Mayor Lucas Cleveland was passed Thursday at a Cobourg Council Committee meeting to possibly revoke the Christian Heritage Month declaration. This following a presentation by Bob LeDrew, who was denied a request by the council to declare March 23rd as Atheist Awareness Day. LeDrew says while Northumberland County is becoming less religious, the council is not applying its own policy equally, more with Dan Jones in Cobourg, Ontario.
Cobourg Council is now rethinking its November decision to declare December Christian Heritage Month. This decision follows a presentation Thursday by Bob LeDrew at Cobourg Council's Corporate Finance and Legislative Standing Committee. LeDrew requested town staff that council declare March 23rd Atheist Awareness Day. He says his request was denied as the town's flag-raising and proclamation policy does not allow for declarations to be issued for religious organizations or events. LeDrew says he's in support of this policy, but believes it's not being equally followed, as council has now set a precedent on religious declarations.
I'm in strong agreement with that policy, as I think government is best done in a secular fashion. Government should be careful to prevent even the perception that they officially approve or sanction a religious organization or faith. If you want to open the door to faith-based proclamations, then you've opened it all the way. If you want to shut that door, it's up to you to shut that door.
LeDrew explains that Northumberland County is becoming less religious. He cited a 2021 Statistics Canada Religious Diversity Report suggesting that approximately 45% of the county's population has no religious affiliation, up from 25% 10 years ago.
Council acted in conflict with its own policies by issuing a proclamation for Christian Heritage Month. Staff made an incorrect decision to deny Atheism Awareness Day, given that atheism is not a religion. Canada and Northumberland County are increasingly secular, and Christians are a minority of the population.
Mayor Lucas Cleveland stated he agreed with Ledroux's premise in his presentation that the declaration policy is not being followed, but suggested that atheism is a religion.
As someone who studied philosophy and theology, I would argue that atheism is as much faith-based as any other faith, and that you have the faith that there is nothing instead of the faith that there is something. But I agree with your premise here, sir, that perhaps our policy, and I agree with your premise that secularist society is the way we should be heading forward.
Cleveland moved a motion to examine the potential to revoke the Christian Heritage Month declaration. Declaration regulations stipulate that once one is made, it is in effect for 5 years. Town Clerk Brent Larmer recommended that council also look into this. Cleveland's motion did pass, and both areas are expected to be discussed further at the January 29th regular council meeting. I'm Dan Jones.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Abakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
The Wilfrid Laurier University has begun its rollout of a new free online Indigenous course that is open to the public. The course Introduction to Indigenous Matters is a self-directed course that the university says can be completed in 6 to 8 hours. Dr. Darren Thomas, Associate Vice President of Indigenous Initiatives at Wilfrid Laurier University, says the course focuses on giving individuals an opportunity to learn about Indigenous peoples' experiences, history and culture, and to educate people on misconceptions and misinformation surrounding them. Over 600 individuals have signed up for the online course so far, and feedback has been very positive, says Thomas. The university is already hoping to expand and offer more Indigenous courses in the future. Andrew Dow in Oshawakin, Ontario, spoke with Dr. Darren Thomas.
This course came out of a request from the city of Brantford, and just to kind of set this up here, Call 57 from the Calls to Action of the TRC asks all municipal governments to inform employees and make available training and education about the social political history of Canada. And myself, as a consultant and working with other cities and municipalities up and down the Grand River, and so the city had actually reached out to us for designing this program and make it available.
Thomas explained that the course focuses on the early history of Canada and looks to educate individuals on that time period to detail the challenges that were faced by Indigenous people.
Many universities across the country do some sort of public education like this. And, you know, I think, you know, especially here in Ontario, what I often joke about, you know, and I mean, it's not a joke in a laughing matter, but what I often tease about is that if you're educated in Ontario, the only little bit of history and knowledge you ever receive is a grade 3 pioneer unit with provincial education. Many provinces across the country, you know, Ontario's kind of in the middle. Some are way far behind, some are way ahead in terms of what we teach about Indigenous people and Indigenous history, and in particular, the settlement history. I think that's where, you know, because that's where you get into all the challenging content and the stuff that, you know, is basically, you know, some of the reasoning why this content isn't available into our school system, because it's an ugly history.
Thomas spoke on the course providing context to the challenges that were faced by Indigenous peoples and his hopes that it can help overcome some of the misconceptions and misinformation surrounding them.
This is the history of Canada, and this needs to be taught, because knowing and understanding the situational context that Indigenous peoples are living in, without unpacking that, you just don't know And the other side of this, Andy, is there's so much misinformation out there about Indigenous people. We don't pay tax. We get everything for free, free house and car and land and all the garbage that's out there in terms of misinformation, that stereotype. This environment of no accurate information and a lot of misinformation creates an environment of a lot of hatred, a lot of anti-Indigenous racism, and of a lot of people just having very little empathy for the lived experiences of Indigenous people. So this course attempts to try to address a lot of high-level stuff about some of the social political history, but also the local history about who Indigenous people are in the neighborhood and along the Grand River. You know, like, we really have to follow the light of the late Senator Sinclair, Justice Sinclair, who led the TRC, and his very famous quote in his time was, "Education got us into this mess, and education is going to get us out." Understanding the social political realities that Indigenous people are continuing to endure, Canadians have to learn that reconciliation has nothing to do with Indigenous people. Reconciliation is about Canadians reconciling with Canadian history.
I'm Andrew Dow, and this news story is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, which supports the creation of original civic journalism.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
University student Jordi Villanova headed a Concordia University delegation and attended the latest COP29 meeting in Baku, Azerbaijan. Jordi Villanova is a PhD student studying biodiversity in Montreal. COP29, as you know, is the United Nations conference, a massive summit on climate change that is attended by delegates from many countries. Villanova attended the meeting despite his initial hesitation. And after his return, Villanova spoke at a climate cafe on January 21st, a monthly event where locals discuss climate change and solutions at the community level. Journalist Adam Innes caught up with him.
I always thought that COPs weren't amounting to anything, and I thought, oh, might as well go there and see what actually happens there. And so I ended up going out of curiosity, actually, try to understand what's happening there and then try to report back what I saw and why there's misunderstandings about COP.
Villanova attended despite initial hesitation.
Negotiations at COP are really extremely important, but not the main thing that's happening there. A lot of the things happening at COP is local level things, more entente between different groups, trying to push for different things. So I really learned that global change is actually happening at a local level, and then we just find ways to make it global. But how we are going to solve climate change is really just pushing these local level initiatives and push them at a global scale. That's the main takeaway that I had from COP.
Villanova says, though he is still skeptical about many aspects of COP, he saw immense value in the networking and discussion that took place there.
I now see more of the value in having people from very, very different political backgrounds sit around the same table.
He was able to discuss his biodiversity work with other delegates. He says at COP he was having educating conversations with other delegates, even about small projects at the local level, discussing things like pollinator gardens and ecological corridors, like the ones here in NDG. He is encouraging that in the community there is more collaboration between groups approaching issues of biodiversity and climate change.
These local level actions are actually having an impact at COP, because people here are learning from all these different people. They are reporting these things back to other organizations that can go to these events. So local level actions are being seen at this international scale. So in NDG, it's extremely important, any action that's being done, because it's trickling up, it's going up, and it's having an impact, even though we don't see it.
I'm Adam Innes.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
Radio. And finally to British Columbia now, where the Lac Les Tenets Nation and the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, the DFO, have partnered up to build a fully staffed hatchery on the north bank of the Nechaco River near the confluence of the Nechaco and the Fraser Valley watershed. This will be one of three facilities built along the Fraser Valley watershed to support salmon populations through the Pacific Salmon Strategy Initiative. Adam Silverstein, Regional Manager of Hatchery Reform and Modernization at the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, spoke with Ian Gregg in Prince George, British Columbia, about the project.
We've worked with the Upper Fraser Fisheries Conservation Alliance and First Nations and Indigenous governments all across the watershed for many years to identify potentially suitable locations for a hatchery. There's lots of different requirements that play into that: access to the fish populations, the right kinds and quality and quantity of both groundwater and surface water, access to service center and employment and response times, because these are 24/7, 365-day operations. So all of those things combine and have made it quite challenging in terms of site selection. And we're fortunate that we've been able to identify this site that has access to significant quantities of groundwater and surface water and is located close to the center of Prince George. So that will allow us to be able to travel to the different watersheds to collect gametes for the hatchery and to release the juvenile fish when they're ready to go back to their native watershed. And it allows us to be in a service center where we can access staffing and other needs of a facility like this. But most importantly, it's close to the river and it's got the right quantity and quality of water that we need.
Locally, salmon have significant cultural, social, and ecological importance. The Lac Les Tenets Nation has been dependent on salmon for generations, but as of late, this hasn't been a central factor in annual harvests. In fact, a lot of salmon stocks throughout our province are in serious long-term decline, and without action, some runs are looking like they may disappear entirely. Do you know what kind of shape our region is in?
We are experiencing pretty severe conservation challenges across the watershed. But that being said, there are a big mix of different populations, different species, and they all have different statuses and trends. And so making one broad comment is difficult. But I think there's no doubt that across the watershed, there are a number of populations that are experiencing the challenges you've outlined. We've seen things like heat domes and different landslides and floods and other events that are creating even more challenges for these populations. And so this new facility is one of the key response measures that we are implementing to try to support these populations. And we're doing that in partnership with the Lac Les Tenets and other First Nations across the watershed because of that cultural importance and the importance of collaboration in terms of getting the right outcome for these fish and for the people that care about them.
So you know that we often have to cut off big chunks of these great conversations between our journalists and their guests. This was the case here with Ian Gregg's interview. Catch up with the rest on frequencynews.ca. And this is how we close our show this week. Thanks to our journalists Ian Gregg, Andrew Dow, Dan Jones, Erica Butler, Adam Innes, and Jules Bugiel. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. Thanks to you for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.